Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. I'm Valentina Iuzzolino, neurologist, clinical neurophysiologist, and a PhD candidate at University of Naples Federico II. My research focus is on neuromuscular and neurodegenerative disorders, especially on ALS. This month, we are exploring the fascinating and increasingly important topic of ALS and frontotemporal dementia. And in today's episode, we will talk about diagnostic challenges in ALS and frontotemporal dementia. My guests today are Professor Elka Stefanova and Professor Mamede De Carvalho. Professor Elka Stefanova is a professor of neurology and the head of the Center for Memory Disorders and Dementia at the Clinical Center of Serbia, specializing in neurodegenerative diseases with a focus on Alzheimer's disease and frontotemporal dementia. Professor Mamede De Carvalho is full professor of physiology at the Lisbon University and a senior consultant neurologist and clinical neurophysiologist at Hospital de Santa Maria, Portugal, internationally recognized for his work in amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, neurophysiology, and neuromuscular disorders. Welcome both, Professor Stefanova and Professor De Carvalho, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting us.
So let's start. I want to start asking to Professor De Carvalho, what is the most frequent clinical presentation of ALS, and what are the most frequent diagnostic pitfalls in early ALS? Which mimics do you find most challenging?
Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk about ALS and in particular now about the conditions that can mimic ALS and presentation of ALS. Both topics are very related. Indeed, the presentation, the region of onset in ALS depends on the age and even the gender or the sex of the patient. For example, old patients tend to have more bulbar presentation, in particular women. And that represents very well that variability of phenotype depends on both factors, the age and the sex, but also depends on ethnicity, because bulbar presentation is more frequent in Western world than in Asia, for example. So there are differences that we have to consider. But in Europe, where you are, about 25-30% of the patients present with bulbar onset, almost always with dysarthria. It's very rare a patient presenting with dysphagia. And the first symptom in bulbar onset is classically a dysarthria that progresses to dysphagia later on. So the most frequent presentation in ALS really is the spinal onset, upper limbs or lower limbs. Occasionally, we have patients presenting with respiratory onset, about 3-5%, which that sometimes is difficult because, I mean, we believe the patient can have a medical condition. And a few patients present with the axial onset, like neck palsy, and that is, again, a difficult phenotype because we don't think about ALS many times when we see a patient like this. The mimicking disorders that we can think about depends on phenotype. That's why the link between both is so important. If you have a patient with bulbar presentation, then we can think if the patient reported that started very rapidly, we can, and the neurologist sometimes they believe it could be a stroke. If it is more slower, the patient reports a slower progression of bulbar involvement, then we have to think about other neurodegenerative disorders, like superbulbar palsy or even Parkinson's disease. And so that depends very much where the disease starts. A patient beginning with upper limbs weakness, if it's a young man, we have to think very seriously about multifocal motor neuropathy with or without conduction block. In older patients, of course, we think about cervical myelopathy. In general, I mean, cervical myelopathy, we have pain, we have sensory changes and sensory symptoms. But anyway, this is something that we have to think about. And in lower limbus onset, if it's very distal and symmetric, a petrichous presentation, then we think about neuropathy, which should be studied. If it's more proximal and unilateral, in the diabetic patient, we can think about plexopathy, although plexopathy is in general associated with very intense pain. And in general, in lower limb onset, root lesions are something that we have to think about and explore with imaging. In patients with upper and lower limb onset, of course, myopathy, in particular if the weakness is more proximal, myopathy is something that we have to think about. And so the mimicking disorder, we think, depends very much about phenotype, and we cannot dissociate both. That's my point.
Thanks. This shows how the clinical heterogeneity is really interesting and really tricky for differential diagnosis. So staying on this topic, in clinical practice, when can we confidently apply the Gold Coast criteria, and how do they compare with earlier criteria like El Escorial and Avashi?
Thank you very much. About the criteria for the disease diagnosis is a very important point. I mean, Gold Coast criteria is a very simple set of conditions. I mean, and that includes the patients with progressive muscle atrophy. In other words, patients with pure lower motor neuron involvement. So by default, it's impossible not to be. A Gold Coast criteria is more sensitive than Awaji, than El Escorial criteria, just because are including patients that were excluded before. That's one point. Another point is that it's very simple. We don't have categories here. So the problem with El Escorial and Awaji, which was more sensitive than El Escorial, but again, following the categories, is that what was difficult for the neurologist, the neurophysiologist, to understand the categories. And inter-rater agreement, there is a very good paper published about this, the inter-rater agreement regarding the categories was poor. Because of that, because it was difficult for them, the neurologists, the neurophysiologists, to keep in mind the complexities of the categories. So this is much simpler. The patient has ALS or has not ALS. And that depends on involvement of two regions with lower motor neuron involvement on the clinical ground or supported by electromyography, or the patient presents with one region with upper and lower motor neuron involvement, at least the minimum. And so they are very simple. There is no paper really studying the inter-rater agreement with the Gold Coast criteria, but for sure is higher than when using the El Escorial or Awaji. So really increased sensitivity for sure by default, by including a group of patients that were excluded. And based on the literature you have, there is no lower specificity. So there is no risk of saying the patient has ALS, not having ALS. So specificity is still high, because we have to exclude other conditions that I have mentioned before by imaging and other methods for the diagnosis, laboratory evaluation, for example, and we have to stress the importance of neurophysiology in supporting diagnosis in ALS in this criteria and in this previous criteria that we have mentioned before.
And how does neurophysiology help resolve diagnostic uncertainty?
Neurophysiology is very essential for diagnosis. We have the privilege in ALS to have a way to measure the generation of the neurons directly, the lower motor neurons in spinal cord, that we don't have in Parkinson's disease, on Alzheimer's disease, in frontotemporal dementia, because we cannot put a needle there to evaluate the generation of the neurons. We have that privilege in ALS. And for diagnosing ALS, we need to find that the disease is not focal, is widespread. And we know that in neurophysiology, you can find changes in muscles which are very well preserved clinically. That is the point. I mean, we have to find that muscle that seems to be completely normal clinically. They are not really normal. They are abnormal on neurophysiology, on EMG. And these are the advantage. Of course, we can trace that with neurophysiology, we have to exclude other conditions. We have to exclude myopathy. We have to exclude conduction blocks when that is reasonable, and etc. But we can find very early changes in muscles that we cannot really replace by using ultrasound, for example. Finding fasciculations in early affected muscles, which is really the first change in the muscles, we can use ultrasound for that. But with ultrasound, we cannot really analyze the morphology of the fasciculation potentials and their stability or instability. And very important is the end plate and the very early change in the end plate function in ALS patients. So you see unstable motor units. And that unstable motor units are just not early, but they are very essential to confirm that the muscle is affected. And that's something that we can really obtain by using needle EMG. And so finding signs of ongoing denervation, a dynamic process of denervation, finding fibrillation sharp waves with needles is very important to show that it's not a chronic condition, it's something that is going on. And this is, again, very important for the diagnosis of ALS. So really, with neurophysiology, we can see the suffering of the lower motor neurons, we can see the dynamic of the disease, we can see changes in normal in muscle that they seem very normal clinically, and all that, that information is essential for supporting diagnosis and also for excluding other conditions that can mimic ALS.
Thanks. This is a very important point, especially in daily clinical practice. And now, turning to FTD, for Professor Stefanova, what are the most common early signs of frontotemporal dementia that are misinterpreted in clinical practice?
Let's start with a short introduction of demographic and clinical characteristics of frontotemporal dementia. It is the spectrum of neurodegenerative disorders, and it is considered as the second most common cause of early onset dementia after Alzheimer's disease. The estimated prevalence is around 20 cases per 100,000 people in general population, with 20% of young onset dementia. The typical onset is between 45 and 65 years of age, which means in the middle age period of life course. Females and males are affected roughly equally. About 40% of patients have a positive family history, with 20% of patients with autosomal dominant inheritance pattern. There are three core clinical syndromes of frontotemporal dementia spectrum. One is the behavior variant, which is the most prevalent in this spectrum, with personality and behavioral changes, like disinhibition, apathy, loss of empathy, compulsive behaviors, changes in eating habits, poor judgment, and executive dysfunction. The second one is primary progressive aphasia, with progressive language impairment, either as non-fluent, a grammatic variant with a forceful speech, or fluent, semantic variant with loss of word meaning or loss of object knowledge. The third one is overlapping syndrome between frontotemporal dementia and motor syndromes. Usually, behavior variant of frontotemporal dementia overlaps with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, corticobasal syndrome, or progressive supranuclear palsy. You are right when you mention that FTD is likely underdiagnosed. especially early in the course of the disease, it is very difficult to differentiate between psychiatric disorders and patient with frontotemporal dementia. It usually misdiagnoses with bipolar disorder, with depression, personality disorders, or atypical Alzheimer's disorders. FTD should be suspected in a middle-aged patient with progressive behavioral or language changes, especially when memory is relatively preserved early in the course of the disease and visuospatial orientation is spared during the course of the disease. This brings us to another important challenge. How do you distinguish between a behavioral frontotemporal dementia and primary psychiatric disorders?
As a neurologist, I must admit that differentiation between frontotemporal dementia and psychiatric disease is one of the biggest real-world diagnostic challenges, especially in the course of the frontotemporal dementia. Behavioral variant can closely resemble depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia spectrum illness, obsessive compulsive disorder, or personality disorders. Therefore, as a neurologist, we usually use several distinguishing features in favor of behavioral variant of frontotemporal dementia. The first one is progressive deterioration. Psychiatric disorders often fluctuate, and usually in behavioral variant, we have gradual but relentless progression, accumulating functional impairment during the course of the disease, worsening of social and occupational dysfunction over time. The message is that serial history or serial visit is often more valuable than a single visit in the clinic. The second distinguishing feature might be loss of social cognition and empathy. The subjects with frontotemporal dementia presents emotional coldness, reduced concerns for others, even for the very close relatives, socially inappropriate comments, violation of interpersonal boundaries. This pattern is less typical in primary mood disorders. The third one is lack of insight. The patient with frontotemporal dementia usually deny behavioral changes, minimize their symptoms, and they have lack of awareness of the consequences of this behavior. Patients with depression, in contrast, often report distress and suffering, and this is the most important differential diagnosis feature. The fourth feature is stereotyped or compulsive behaviors, which could start early in the course of the disease, like repetitive rituals, pacing, very fixed routines, hoarding, or changes in eating habits. These behaviors are highly supportive of behavioral variant when it is progressive. The fifth favoring feature is neurologic or cognitive, something like executive dysfunction, which is present either in neuropsychological testing or in everyday life, with impaired verbal fluency, without strategy, without planning, or utilization behavior, presence of the primitive reflexes, or you can find the signs for motor neuron disease or Parkinsonism in some syndromes. memory and visuospatial abilities may be relatively preserved early in the course or even during the course of the disease. The most important thing and the most important issue is the collateral history, or the history which is given from the memory, from the family member or caregiver or co-worker. It is essential because the patient often lacks insight, or relatives can describe personality changes longitudinally. Usually, they say that the person is not the same as it is used to be. And this is the very highest yield components of assessment. We can finish this introduction with red flags which suggesting behavioral variant rather than psychiatric disorder. When you have to consider the new psychiatric presentation after the age of 45 as a key distinguishing feature for behavior variant of frontotemporal dementia. Progressive personality change, marked disinhibition or apathy, compulsive eating or altered food behavior, or family history of dementia, ELS, or psychiatric disease, poor response to psychiatric treatment, or functional decline despite stable mood.
Thanks. I think you touched on a key issue there, early recognition, longitudinal evaluation to get all soft signs and so-called red flags, no? So, along the same line, what key imaging and CSF findings support the diagnosis of frontotemporal dementia in clinical practice?
Unfortunately, nowadays, the diagnosis of frontotemporal dementia is still clinical. We do not have enough specific or enough sensitive CSF or blood biomarkers for frontotemporal dementia, as we have got in Alzheimer's disease. Neurologists in everyday clinical practice usually are looking for additional diagnostic tools like neuropsychological testing, structural MRI, or FDG PET scanning. Or in familiar cases, we are searching for certain gene mutation in C9orf72 or MAPT or progranulin. MRI usually could present the asymmetrical or bilateral frontotemporal atrophy. Very similarly, in FDG PET scanning, we are seeing the hypometabolism in these affected regions.
Thanks. That's extremely relevant. And now, before we close, I would like to thank again Professor Stefanov and Professor De Carvalho for this extremely insightful discussion. Today's conversation really highlighted how ALS and frontotemporal dementia should no longer be considered completely separate disorders, but rather part of a broader neurodegenerative spectrum, where motor, cognitive, and behavioral symptoms can overlap in complex ways. Professor Stefanova reminded us that frontotemporal dementia is not a single entity, but an heterogeneous clinical spectrum. One of the key take-home messages is that behavioral or personality changes are often misinterpreted as psychiatric disorders. Recognizing the so-called red flag is essential for an earlier and more accurate diagnosis. Another very important point discussed today is the current lack of definitive biomarkers for FTD in routine clinical practice. Because of this, neuroimaging still plays a central role. Professor De Carvalho also emphasized how challenging the diagnosis of ALS can be, particularly in bulbar phenotype or early or slowly progressive presentation. We discussed how important it is to combine careful clinical observation with the neurophysiology, not only to support the diagnosis of ALS, but also to exclude important mimics. Another important message from today is that diagnostic criteria are a useful tool, but they should never replace clinical judgment. The Gold Coast criteria have improved sensitivity and may facilitate early diagnosis, but uncertainty is still part of real-world clinical practice. So the key take-home message is probably this: early recognition of cognitive, behavioral, and motor symptoms, together with the multidisciplinary and longitudinal approach, is essential to improve diagnostic accuracy and patient care. Thank you again to Professor Stefanova and Professor De Carvalho for joining us today. And thank you to our listener for tuning into EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thanks.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.